one of the biggest things is they were a team. Like, they had played together as a team, like any team would, like a lacrosse team or football team or baseball team. And so they had a kind of camaraderie and a kind of power structure, I think, that allowed them to deal with the situation more rapidly than they would have if they were strangers. I think there are cases like this where strangers were trapped on trains and things, and they were not able to survive that long. In some cases, it's less about individual bravery and more about, can you function as a unit? Can you function as a team, as a group? And I think the fact that they had experience on the playing field and had relationships and sort of had, were used to these kind of raw observations on life and time in the locker room, enabled them to cut through a lot of the stuff that would have held up other people and get right to the heart of the matter. And I think they, and they would speak about this, that their stature as a team enabled them to kind of endure, especially in those early days.
That is ABC News contributor Chris Connolly talking about this new doc series, Prisoner of the Snow, that he's hosting. And it follows this amazing story of a soccer team that plane crashes in the Andes and they have to survive in the snow for 71 days. And that's him talking about why he thinks they were able to survive, or one of the reasons. It's a really, really interesting conversation and pretty intense, but spellbinding, as they say. And I think you're going to really enjoy it. Before we get to that, I'm in this sort of like no team, sports team to root for desert that I'm living in, right? So the Bruins, they choked and they didn't make it farther into the playoffs. The Celtics, my Celtics, they choked. They should be in the finals right now. And the Red Sox, it's a little league team, basically. They were playing the Toronto Blue Jays today. They literally threw the ball around and the guy ran from first to home. And then everybody went out and got pizza at Chuck E. Cheese. I can't watch them. I have no team to watch. So I'm going to just go to little league games. I'll be probably, it's not going to be creepy. I'm just going to watch and yell at the kids like I used to yell at my kid when he would play and not wait on the ball or, you know, not focus out in the field and then have a weird ride home. Anyway, I think I'm revealing too much right now. Hey, by the way, I'm going to be taking permission to speak my Off-Broadway show out on tour in the fall. We're starting to book dates. We're going to start announcing some of those soon. Very excited. That was a show directed by Frank Oz with set design by Jim Van Hagen, who's a set designer for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert that I work on. Anyway, show's coming, and I hope you guys can see it when it's coming to your area. And we'll tell you more about that as it gets closer to the fall. In the meantime, enjoy Chris Connolly. Hey, Chris.
Well, I'm glad this meeting is being recorded. I feel better now.
Now you go. Here you go. You know what I'm talking? Wait, this is a real professional operation here.
I totally understand. Yes. Thank you for having me.
How are you? How are you? Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you as well.
I've always enjoyed your writing, going back to Rolling Stone and your work.
Oh my God. You seem a little young for the Rolling Stone.
Oh, no.
For the Rolling Stone history, since was like 35 years ago.
Well, we used to.
Meanwhile, attended the world premiere of Chuck. So at the Triborough Film Festival. So I am familiar with your work as Goomba Partier.
Oh my God. You are amazing in your. In your research, I am honored that you would know my brilliant 26 seconds of acting. I am so honored.
You know, not everybody can fill those shoes on a shoot like that. So I very much enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, I thought it was really great because, you know, Liev Schreiber like produced it. I think he bought the rights to his production company or whatever. But yeah, I thought it was really well done. And there were things I learned about, you know, that whole story of, you know, the real life Rocky Balboa story, that I didn't know. And then, you know, doing scenes with Liev Schreiber was pretty interesting. At one point in between takes, he would turn and have dumbbells and he would like do dumbbell curls, like facing the wall. My agent told me he was like a really intense actor. And I was like, whoa, okay. And I saw it firsthand and I was like, so I got two pencils and I started to curl those, but it didn't really have the same effect. You know?
Occasionally, I find myself accidentally listening to a documentary that he hasn't narrated.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a little jarring.
Exactly. Well, we're jumping right in here. We're talking with Chris Conley, the contributor to ABC News, Good Morning America, 2020 Nightline, correspondent for ESPN. Just a really, really great reporter, journalist, storyteller. And you have a new documentary out, Prisoners of the Snow, streaming on Hulu. And based on this, it was, you know, I remember reading the book Alive about this, you know, based on this sort of harrowing 3 days on the Andes Mountain after a plane crash. The survivors, five of the survivors are part of this documentary. It's great to have you on. We have no more time because we did talk about my movie career. So I think we're done now. I apologize. No, I'm just kidding. Great to have you on.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I actually went down to South America in 2007 with ESPN to do a story on this and to talk to some of the survivors. And so, you know, that was like a 12-minute story that people were very nice about. But to be able to do like 2 hours for ABC News Studios with five of the survivors and really and just an amazingly detailed and, you know, emotionally powerful account of the 72 days these guys spent in the mountains in the Andes after their plane crashed, and somehow managed to survive. I mean, it's just an incredible, it's probably the greatest survival story of the 20th century. And that this rugby team going to a game in Chile just had their plane go down 14,000 feet above sea level, you know, crash with nothing living around them and somehow managed to survive for 2 months is just astonishing. And you'll see what they went through, how they survived, and what they endured in great detail out of their mouths and out of the mouths of some experts who can tell you just how bad their lives were up there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I did read the book, and I am very familiar with the story, but I know that there are things in this documentary that perhaps not a lot of people know. But one of the perspectives that was fascinating to me is the survival expert's point of view on this and how they survived. Because, as you said, 72 days, what were a couple of, without giving too much away so people watch it, but what were some of the sort of perspectives that you got from the survival experts that either surprised them that they were able to survive this long, or you know, maybe.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff I'd never known before. And like you, I read the book Alive. I think I saw the movie Alive too. And one of the things that was special about Alive when it came out was it was a voice of all of the survivors sort of speaking as one. And in this case, you get like five different perspectives because they each kind of went through different things. And like you say, there are these other experts sort of telling you what exactly happened. For example, one of the real heroes of this story is a guy named Nando Parado, who is one of the people who really helps rally the survivors to stay alive, and then is one of the two expeditionaries who literally walks out of the mountain for 12 days and finds help and helps the team actually get rescued. And he suffers a skull fracture in the actual crash, you know, and according to one of our medical experts, the reason why he was able to survive was because it was so cold. The fact that they were in sub-zero temperatures up there on the mountain actually allowed him to endure this incredible injury and to bounce back in a way he would not have been able to do if he'd not gotten medical attention at sea level. So that's just one of the insights that you kind of get that even the guys on the mountain didn't realize, in terms of what they were able to go through and how they managed to persevere through the deaths of their friends and loved ones, through landslides, and, as was widely reported, through having to consume the bodies of the dead.
Mm. What always amazed me about this is what one can do when faced with life or death, right? And how you can rise above something where you know, against all odds, not to sound too cliche. And I would think that that's a part of this as well, right? Like that these are rugby players. These aren't survival experts. These aren't people that have climbed many mountains. Like how do you stay positive. I do think there's one point in the story that they find out that the search rescue has been called off. And one of them says, we have good news. The search has been called off. Now we can get out of here. And like, how did they maintain that level of positivity through all of this?
Well, you make some good points. I mean, that's very much true. And I think you sort of hit on what one of the keys was. They were young. They were in great shape. They were kind of fearless in their kind of young, carefree way. And for me, one of the biggest things is they were a team. Like they had played together as a team, like any team would, like a lacrosse team or football team or baseball team. And so they had a kind of camaraderie and a kind of power structure, I think, that allowed them to deal with the situation more rapidly than they would have if they were strangers. I think there are cases like this where strangers were trapped on trains and things, and they were not able to survive that long. In some cases, it's less about individual bravery and more about, can you function as a unit? Can you function as a team, as a group? And I think the fact that they had experience on the playing field and had relationships and sort of were used to these kind of raw observations on life and time in the locker room, enabled them to cut through a lot of the stuff that would have held up other people and get right to the heart of the matter. And I think they would speak about this, that their stature as a team enabled them to kind of endure, especially in those early days.
What I think is really great about this is it's all these years after. And as you said, the book, you never really got a sense of the individuals through the book and the film that was done a long time ago, but it really was from a more of a group perspective, this experience. So now you have five of the survivors. How did this change them in their life? I would imagine it had to. Did any of the survivors speak to that? And are they a different person today, all these years later, because of that? What happened?
Well, it's, you know, it would have been a Bildungsroman era for them anyway, right? Like they were young guys kind of coming into adulthood. And so the transformations that we see in movies or read in novels were going to take place in their lives regardless. And these were well-educated guys, you know, who were off to, you know, interesting lives regardless. But someone like Nando Parado, who would go on to become an entrepreneur and a race car driver and a filmmaker, one of the things that motivated him was how many members of his family he lost in the crash. When he came back, his sister had died and his mother had died, and he had to sort of tell his father what had happened. And so there was a kind of live for today thing, I think, that kicked in. Mm-hmm. You know, Roberto Canessa, who was another one of the heroes of this expedition, who walked out of the mountains and who got help for his friends still stranded next to the shattered aircraft. He became a pediatric cardiologist and would eventually run for president in Uruguay. So these guys were not one-trick ponies. Like these were passionate, like intense, really smart guys who went on to lead lives of great achievement. And it was just sitting across from them when I went down there for ESPN was really startling, just because they had lived these really rich, full lives. And in some cases, they talked about their time in the mountains like survivors. And they could also use a kind of poetic language as they thought about it. You know, so, you know, sometimes when you would listen to astronauts, the astronauts would be kind of, oh, you went to the moon. Yeah, I went to the moon. Wasn't that great? You know, but these guys really could kind of get into a lot of what the emotional experience had been like, some of the things they did. And you just sit rapt as they spoke and you get to hear from five of them. Now, one of these guys, Roy Harley, this poor guy was asked to fix the radio because he was a technical guy. So can't you fix the radio so we can broadcast a message that we need to get rescued? And he must have spent days trying to fix the radio, and he never could because there wasn't enough equipment on the mountain. Yeah. But they got him off, and 14 or 15 of those guys survived, and it's a miracle.
I think you really make a good point about youth. Probably was a real there was an ally to them, you know, because when you're that young, you think you're invincible, even in that situation, right? You don't get down maybe the way a 40-year-old might get down and go, oh, geez, life sucks. We're never going to get out of here. You're like, you know, whatever you are, you're in your 20s or whatever, and you just think anything is possible. Did you find all of these years later that you hear this sometimes that the ones that survived have guilt about surviving vis-a-vis the others that didn't.
Yeah, one of them very much. Yeah, one of the people you'll see in the Hulu special, you know, one of them very much has that and has spoke and spoke to us about that and spoke, I think, about getting some sort of therapy for it, you know, because it wasn't a meritocracy up there. Like the people who survived didn't survive because they were stronger or braver or more resilient. They're all sleeping one night and they got crushed in an avalanche. And some of their best guys died in the avalanche. And that was just luck of the draw. Where you were sitting in the plane had a lot to do with where you're going to survive. So, you know, they knew that life or death in many respects for them was just a crapshoot. Like they didn't, you know, the guys who survived weren't better. They weren't more heroic. You know, it was a question of luck and of good fortune. And so, like you say, at least one of them really articulated those feelings. You know, why me and not somebody else? Because the guys they lost were really special guys. You know, one of the guys, Marcelo, had been kind of the leader. He'd been the team captain. And so when he survived the crash, he was kind of giving out the job. You take care of this and you do the medical stuff and you try to get some water. And again, that team structure helping these guys to stay alive. And he lost his life in the middle of the night in an avalanche, you know, not because he wasn't strong or brave, but just because of bad luck. So you're absolutely right. There is some of that very much going.
Yeah. How did they decide on Nando and Roberto to be the two to walk out to try to find help, which they ultimately do, and speak to when they get to the river and they see a farmer on the other side and how they actually are able to convey that they need help, because it's really quite unbelievable how they have to get the message to this farmer.
Well, they have very different energies, Nando and Roberto, and you'll see that in the Hulu show. You know, Nando is the first to sort of say the mountain is killing us. Like as weirdly comfortable as we might be here sitting on the mountain is killing us and I'm getting out of here. He was kind of the first to say that, like, I've got to go and get some help. Roberto, you know, kept sort of wondering, well, do we go now or do we go later? Like, you know, should we wait until the season changes a little bit and should we go up or down? And so these two guys who weren't friends, although they were on the same team, who didn't know each other very well, complemented each other in a kind of way. And so they became the two guys who climbed up to the top of the mountain where they expected to see this green valley. All we got to do is get to the top of the mountain and we'll see this green valley and we'll be safe. And they got to the top of the mountain and all they saw were more mountains and more snow. You know, it was a crushing emotional moment. We're never getting out of here is what they thought. They're walking on, you know, the shoes that they wore on the plane. You know, they're wearing, you know, every warm clothing that they could find, but still not very much. And yet they keep going. They go for days and days and days, and then they finally go below the frost line. They start to see the first, like, live beings they've seen in 2 months. I just mean, like, grass and flowers, which they hadn't seen up on the mountain. Birds and maybe the occasional animal. And then Roberto spots a man on a horseback. He's an itinerant farmer named Sergio Catalan. And they yell to him. They yell frantically to him. And Sergio Catalan says one word to them. He says, mañana. And he rides off, and then he comes back the next day. And because he's on the other side of this loud river, and you remember this from the Hulu special, they can't hear each other very well.
Right.
They can't, like, explain what's happened to them. And so this itinerant farmer ties a ballpoint pen, I think, and a piece of paper to a rock and throws it across the river. And Nando Parado writes on this piece of paper something like, we come from a plane that has crashed in the mountain, you know, and he says everything that happens. And then he puts the rubber band around the rock and around the piece of paper. And now he's got to throw it back. But he's exhausted. He's been walking for 12 days. He's been on a mountain for like 2 months. He has no strength in his arm. So we can't do an overhand throw like he normally would. He has to do like a softball throw. And he's got to put everything into it, because if it just lands in the river, they're never getting rescued. And somehow he gets it across the river. Sergio Catalan picks it up and rides 12 hours to the nearest police station. And that's when they get rescued. I mean, it's just an amazing story. And there are moments like that throughout this whole story.
Yeah, it's amazing. He writes on the note, "I come from a plane that fell into the mountains." It's like unbelievable. Well, listen, it's an amazing documentary. I'm so glad you guys made this, because there's so much more that or details that haven't been revealed up to this point. So it is on Hulu, Prisoners of the Snow. Chris Conley, really big fan of your work, and great to have you on. And we'll talk again soon.
Paul, thank you so much.
All right, there you go. That's Chris. Permission to speak. My Off-Broadway show is coming out in the fall. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Leave some nice reviews on Apple if you don't mind. And we will see you guys next week.